Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and then Detroit, Michigan. And in 1949, he became one of the first African-Americans to be accepted to West Point. He served in the U.S. Army for 23 years, including as an artillery battalion commander in Vietnam and as a military assistant to the Undersecretary of the Army. For 15 years, he also held a number of leadership positions at General Motors. The author of The Black Knight, his name, Colonel Clifford Worthy, Jr., and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to an American hero, Colonel Cliff Worthy, Jr. Colonel, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
A lot of people know you, admire you. I think the first question they want to know is, sir, how are you doing?
Well, I'm slowly recovering from some surgery I had recently. I had some twisted intestines, and they went in and to check those out, and they found out that my appendix were involved somehow. And it's strange that appendix for a guy my age, usually the appendix are gone many years ago, but they were still there. And so they fixed both problems, and so I'm on the mend from that.
Are you good enough to do the dishes?
My wife would probably answer no.
All right. Let's start by talking about your childhood in Atlanta and your mom and your dad, please.
Yeah, I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, and I don't remember a lot about my childhood in Atlanta. More about my extended family that was located in and around Macon, Georgia. But I was born in Atlanta. And we moved here to Detroit, or Hamtramck particularly, in 1939. And I was 11 years old at the time. And I went to Hamtramck High School and graduated in 1944.
What's the biggest thing, sir, you learned from Mom? And what's the biggest thing you learned from Dad?
Wow. Well, the biggest thing I learned from Dad is to listen to Mom.
No truer words were ever spoken.
And the biggest thing I learned from Mom, she had been a teacher of a one-room schoolhouse in and around Macon, Georgia. I think it was Crawford County, to be specific. And so she was a very literate person. She loved to read. She had a great memory and she would memorize stuff. And I kind of got that tendency from her, although my memory isn't as good as hers was. But that was the greatest takeaway. She loved children. And my dad was gone a lot, so she pretty much raised me. And she was my mom.
We're talking to Colonel Clifford Worthy, who's recently written a book called The Black Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T. And I want to read the first paragraph from page 1, chapter 1. Chapter's entitled Walking Through the Door. Here's the first paragraph. I'm not the product of privilege, but I am from solid stock. The values flowing through my ancestral bloodstream are biblically based, and most likely you will find they are values that flow through your family as well. I was taught that the road to fulfillment in life is paved by the relentless pursuit of excellence and steadfast trust that God will guide us.
That's it. I staunchly believe that. My mother, again, you're talking about my mother again, she was probably responsible for that attitude and that philosophy in my life. I had a very strong extended family who as I've noted in the book, wanted me to become a doctor. I was kind of like their, would be their family doctor for literally hundreds of people. So that's, and then the story that you just read kind of reflects the preface and the and forward that you you'll find further in the book, one by my daughter and one by Congressman Dingell, the recently deceased Congressman Dingell.
How was it you went to Wayne State, and what did you study?
I was a pre-med student at Wayne State. Again, as I mentioned before, that since my family, extended family particularly, wanted me to be a doctor, that's why I went to school. I graduated from Hamtramck High School, and I was only 16 years old. And the chances of my actually getting into med school were probably zero to none. And even if I had been accepted, my folks couldn't afford to send me there. And that was what opened the door for me to get to West Point. And if you want me to continue on that vein, I'll go right ahead and tell you why.
We're going to break for a commercial, but when we come back, we're going to talk about West Point.
Okay.
And you being one of the first African Americans in our history to ever attend West Point. We're talking to Colonel Clifford Worthy Jr., and I'm Jack Krasula. And this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, and we're with Colonel Cliff Worthy, who had a son and two daughters. One of the daughters, Kim Worthy, is our Wayne County prosecutor today. And in the preface of The Black Knight, John Dingell Jr. said this: "If my father, John Dingell Sr., had not taken that chance in the 40s of sending a young African-American student from Detroit to West Point, Cliff would not have had his remarkable career. And as you will read in this memoir, without Cliff's life of service, I doubt that we would have his daughter today, Kim Worthy, serving as our Wayne County prosecutor." So, sir, back in 47, 48, what did you know about West Point?
Practically nothing. I had this encounter with this young man who had been found, to use a West Point term, who had flunked out at West Point. He was, for some reason, both of us were in the main building there, at an old main building, they used to call it, at Wayne before it became Wayne State. I recognized him because he was still wearing his West Point uniform. And at that, during those days, when you went to the movies, the first thing you saw was the cadets marching. They kind of introduced the movie, if you recall. Well, anyway, I recognized that, so I was curious and introduced myself. We had a long conversation. I asked a lot of questions, and I told him about my plans to go to med school, but that was probably not going to happen. So he said, well, why don't you apply for an appointment to West Point? Well, before that moment, I had never even given West Point a thought as a career. I didn't know anything more about it than what I've just told you about seeing them march. And so it was a new revelation for me. And back in those days, 3-cent stamp. So what could I lose? So I did write the letter, expecting nothing, by the way. But a couple of weeks later, I got a response back from Congressman Dingell saying, send me your grades and make contact with a couple of local politicians, which I did. The politicians part was easy. The grades part was kind of questionable because the university at that time sort of took the attitude, well, this is, they were very, very quizzical and almost amused by the fact that we even asked them my grade for a black kid to go to West Point. But I did, and off they went to Congressman Dingell. That's how it started, the ball rolling, and I didn't get into West Point that first year. But 3 years later, 1949, I entered the grounds of United States Military Academy at West Point through the persistence of Congressman John Dingell Jr.
I believe that West Point was started by Thomas Jefferson in 1802, and its motto to this day is duty, honor, country.
Exactly.
What do those three words mean to you, Colonel?
They are they're the heart and soul of West Point. From the day you walk on their grounds until you graduate, you'll hear something related to duty, honor, country. And that's a motto or whatever word you want to use for it. It just sustains and upholds the history of that place, that university.
Take us back to 1949, the first week at West Point. What was that like, sir?
Like nothing I'd ever seen before. You got there. Train brought you up to West Point. The first thing you heard was somebody yelling at you, "Drop those bags." You'd be carrying your bags with you. You dropped them, and then they just went into a whole litany of stuff that you had to learn and know, and what you were there for, and you really felt that. As of this moment, I no longer belong to Detroit, Michigan, or Wayne, or anybody else. I belong to West Point. And that duty, honor, country thing was started right then and there, and we lived with it for 4 years.
Jumping ahead, you graduated in 1953. There were 514 cadets that graduated. Mm-hmm. When you started 4 years before, there were only three African Americans in your class, mm-hmm. and the three of you roomed together.
Right. And the reason we roomed together was when you got to West Point, they assigned you to companies based on your height. And that was for parade purposes. They wanted to be sure that there was no bobbing and marching. Everybody, it made the parade look much better than if you had people of different heights with bouncing up and down. And that was the rule at that time. And at West Point, that was the only, I guess, remnant of the pre-Truman Edict of 1948. We had to room together, the black cadets. They did not integrate the rooming. And as one of my roommates, about 4 inches shorter than me and the other one. And he had a tough time because they put him in the middle of the ranks to hide him as much as they could. And he'd have to take these long strides, bobbing up and down steps, trying to keep up with it. And then he's being yelled at all the time. So that's the story.
While you were at West Point, you played squash and tennis.
Yes.
You actually became the captain of the West Point squash team. You said in your book you didn't grow up with privilege, but where did you ever learn to play squash and tennis?
I had never played squash before I got to West Point. But I had played tennis on the courts at Northwestern High School back in those days. So one day I was just walking, walking along the campus grounds and watching the tennis players play. And I looked at them and I said, well, I can play about like the level they're playing. So I met the coach and offered and asked if I could try out. And I did, and he kept me there on the tennis team. The squash portion of it was different because I had never played squash before. But he, I guess, felt that my ability to play tennis, and there's some similarities to racket sports, he could teach me how to play squash, and that's exactly what he did. And ultimately, I did become the captain of the squash team.
All right. 514 of you graduated in June of 1953. Colonel, what do you remember about graduation day?
That was the day we all dreamed of. That day, that's what we lived for. It was graduation day. And I remember the process was this. You'd line up as a candidate to graduate. And up until that time, you had not maintained close relationship with the rest of the class or the rest of the Corps cadets. And as a result of that, it was just a historic day because that's what you were there for. You had spent four trying years there, and you wanted that more than anything else. And that just was a turning point in my life.
Speaking of a historic day, a dream day, a turning point in your life, you had another such day the day after.
Yes.
What did you do the day after you graduated?
Well, I was married the day after I graduated. And that's an interesting observation because there are a lot of other cadets were married the day after graduation, about 10 of them, as I recall. So we graduated at the chapel there at West Point, and all of us went through the same ceremony. You'd have a service, you go outside, you walk through the saber bearers. That was just for kind of historically, that's what you did when you got married up there. And the thing that was beautiful about it was that they were able to get 10 people married in a fairly, really short period of time. Because it was so well constructed and well coordinated that we never felt rushed. We had our ceremony. We had a chance to take pictures. We did the usual things that you do when you get married. And we did it without feeling that we were pushed or interrupting anybody else.
The most beautiful thing about that service was your new wife, Lillian. So we're talking to Colonel Clifford Worthy, and I'm Jack Fasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Colonel Cliff Worthy, who served in the U.S. Army for 23 years. Jumping ahead to 1967, this is the cat's meow, you were selected to attend the Command and General Staff College in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Mm-hmm. Talk about those 9 months.
They were 9 months where officers... early field grade or late field grade, either majors or lieutenant colonels usually, went to prepare them for assignments on general staff and command assignments as well. And it was not attended just by American officers. It was officers from all over the world. In fact, we had about 1,300 officers attending a nine-month course. And there was, I think, 1,347. And Colin Powell was a classmate of mine. He was the number two graduate, so it tells you, it sort of gave you an idea of what his future, what laid ahead for him in the future. Anyway, I didn't get to know him that well because they assigned us to sections based on our alphabetical order. So P is not very close to W, so I wasn't in one of his sections. So I didn't see a lot of him except when they had social events. I didn't get to meet him. But we did have a mutual friend, Tom Carter.
We're talking to Colonel Cliff Worthy, who's recently written his autobiography entitled The Black Knight, mm-hmm. K-N-I-G-H-T. If you want to learn more about it, it's available from Amazon and from Barnes & Noble. Sir, a year later, 1968, right after the Tet Offensive, you're assigned to service in Vietnam. Talk about the command that you led in Vietnam.
Yeah. Well, I got the assignment following my 9 months at the Command and General Staff College. Went to Vietnam and was given a command of a field artillery battalion up in the northern part of southern South Vietnam. And it was part of a corps, a unit. It was field artillery. We had both howitzers and guns, 8-inch howitzers, 175-millimeter guns, making up the battalion weapon system. And we were in support, fire support, of many, many different units at different times. In fact, our batteries had to operate autonomously a lot. They would just be farmed out to different places, so it made command and control a bit more difficult because you had to fly in and fly out, and then they would be kind of on their own, and they had to make their own security arrangements. But that was the layout as far as my battalion was concerned. And I'm very pleased to say that despite that kind of war it was, where you didn't really know who the enemy was sometimes, and there were oftentimes you were attacked and you had to protect yourself, or the unit that you were supporting had to provide protection. But I was blessed that I never lost a soldier. As a matter of fact, when I turned my battalion over to the next commander the day following, he lost 5 soldiers, but I never lost one.
When you and the kids that you led came back in the late 60s, we treated them awful. Some of us treated them awful. If there's a Vietnam veteran listening tonight, what do you say to that veteran?
Well, actually, I was so busy fighting the war that I didn't know about this anti-war system. I wasn't a bit aware of it. But I would say to them, you know, a lot of young men, we lost 58,000 troops over there. And they did a marvelous job under very trying conditions. You know, when you don't know who the enemy is, and when you're restricted on where you can fire but you don't want to harm civilians, it makes it even more difficult. And the terrain itself, the jungles and that sort of thing. I would say, there may have been some reasons, maybe some justification for that kind of thinking, but on balance, I would say, thank God for those troops. One of the things I'd learned in Vietnam was how resourceful the American troops are. In fact, I would say that separates the American Army from any other army in the world, because the American soldiers know how to get things done. And that was certainly the case in Vietnam. And I think they earned the honor and respect of the country. Now, that was apparently not well known or did not occur that. Because later on, I got involved in something else at the Pentagon with that. While I was commanding the artillery battalion in Vietnam, I was assigned a young captain, doctor, who was going to be my battalion surgeon, Joe Babb. And he was anything but a soldier. But my executive officer, Colonel Ray Spence, taught him how to be a soldier. But the point I wanted to make was that he was more than just my battalion. He just saw, when he saw a need, he wanted to fix it. So he got involved with the community, with the non-combatants. And there was a whole host of people, Korean people that were dying for some reason that they didn't know what was causing it. Well, he got involved, found out that they were living under conditions where they were being bitten by rats. And this was causing what he learned was the bubonic plague. Nobody had known anything about that at that time. But he was the one who had uncovered it. And ultimately, he became not only the guy in Vietnam who knew most about the plague, but he became an international authority on plague. And so he was a tremendous young man who accepted his responsibility as my battalion's soldier, but he also reached out to the community and made a tremendous difference, not only in Vietnam, but the years following Vietnam after he had been discharged.
In 1975, you lost Lillian.
Mm-hmm.
The love of your life. So you became a widower with 3 young children.
Mm-hmm.
Your son, Mark,
mm-hmm.
your 2 daughters.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get through that?
It was difficult because it was totally unexpected. My wife started complaining about some numbness and balance problems. And our next-door neighbor at Fort Sill was a post-neurosurgeon. And he examined her and decided there was undue pressure in the upper part of her spine, in the vicinity of her neck. And he felt that it would be a relatively safe operation to fix the problem. But he wanted her to go ahead and get a second opinion. So he sent us up to the University of Oklahoma's Medical Center in Oklahoma City. Went up there, and the doctor there came to the same conclusion that surgery was which would fix the problem. It didn't. She was paralyzed from the neck down after the first surgery. They went in and did a second surgery, and it didn't work either. And after a while, her vital signs were stable enough, they thought. They took her out of an ICU setup situation, put her into a room with another patient, she passed that night based on a massive hemorrhage. And another sad part of that was my daughter Kim was going to the University of Michigan at that time. And I told her it wasn't necessary for her to come home because we didn't think there was going to be any complications. Or that she would probably be home. My wife would be home in just a few days. So I didn't tell Kim about the seriousness of it. And when she passed, Kim was really upset and distraught about it. She. One of the things she mentioned in her preface was the fact that we had some rocky times, and that was one of the times we had because I had not informed her about the status of her mother.
We're talking to Colonel Clifworthy, who became a widower in 1975. Your son, Mark, was 21, Kim was 19, Jennifer was 15, and Mark, developmentally disabled. Talk about Mark, who we lost in 2014.
Yeah, Mark was, when he was born, they kept him in an incubator for 5 days after his birth. And when he came home, he was a very, very slow learner. He didn't walk until he was 27 months old. And he the best wording I've got on his condition was a lack of oxygen at birth. Well, and he was very late bloomer, and he just didn't. So we knew we had a problem. So we began our quest for finding out who could help him. We went to such places as Walter Reed and Johns Hopkins, and everywhere we thought we could get some help, we did, and nothing really worked until. Later on, we had got some relief when he attended a school called Devereaux in Victoria, Texas. But it was heartbreaking. Lillian really was very hard on her, and it may have contributed to her condition. I'm not sure, but it was just devastating.
Tell us about the child that we all know, Kim Worthy.
Kim,
and respect.
Kim was a bright child. She, we had our problems with Mark, so we probably didn't give Kim as much attention as she deserved, as she wanted. But anyway, she didn't seem to need it. She was just a really strong-willed and very smart young lady. We were blessed to have a good school for her to go to, and I think that had a lot to do with her upbringing. But anyway, she, from as long as I can remember, she's always know what she wanted to do with her life. She wanted to be a lawyer. She never veered from that. She wanted to be a judge. She never veered from that. And so she's always had a mind of her own, and one of the things that I've always said to people in the past is Kim, if you wanted her to get something to do something, just tell her she couldn't do it. I guarantee it would get done.
And your other daughter, Jennifer?
She was different than Kim, a very sweet girl, but she just had a different outlook on life. She loved the arts. She loved she learned to play the piano. She wrote poetry, and to this day, that's what she likes to do.
We're talking to Colonel Cliff Worthy, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to an American hero, Colonel Cliff Worthy, who was born in 1928. Figure that one out. He also served from 76 to 91 a number of leadership positions at General Motors. God has given you some great challenges in your life, Colonel, and some great blessings. And in 1979, he gives you another blessing, Mildred.
Yeah, well, we were married in 1979, and I had retired from the Army in 1976, and I was in the process of finding a job. And the reason I retired was because my first wife, Lillian, had passed, and I couldn't be chasing all over the world with youngsters and a son, and special needs son. So I decided, for their sake, I probably should retire. And retire in this area since I had a lot of family. But I went to Wilmington, Delaware to conduct some interviews with DuPont and RCA and probably others that I can't think of at the moment. And Mildred was a resident. She owned an apartment there. And my cousin was a resident in that apartment. And I met Mildred through my cousin. And my cousin, I think, sort of played Cupid in that meeting. And we got to know each other, had dinner a couple of times. And that started a long distance courtship where I'd go to Wilmington, Delaware, or she'd come to Michigan. And we finally decided to get married in 1979. She was a teacher at that time in the school system in Wilmington, Delaware, and obviously a wonderful woman.
Well, she's still a teacher today, trying to teach you new tricks. Okay, that's a different story. We're talking to Colonel Cliff Worthy, who's written a book, autobiography, entitled The Black Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T. It's available on Amazon and also Barnes & Noble. Sir, the last page, the last chapter is entitled Homeward Bound, page 209. Here's how you end the book. I leave you with Proverbs 3, verse 5 and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not rely on your own insight. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make straight your paths. Why did you end the book that way?
Because that's exactly how I felt about my relationship with the Lord. It started at West Point, actually. When I was a plebe, they would allow cadets to go to the chaplain's office early, leave breakfast, and go to the chaplain's office early for Bible study. That started my spiritual destiny right there at West Point. And later on, I had an assignment at Fort Bliss, Texas, and I met a classmate of mine who was a member of an organization called the Officers Christian Union. And it was a group of officers that got together, formed initially in the British Army, and I guess back in 1851 or some number, earlier date. And what he would do was the families would get together, they'd have Bible study and refreshments, and they did that on a monthly basis. The hosting of it would be done by members of the Officers Christian Union. And it was during that time when I finally made a decision for Christ as a result of that contact with an officer named Bob Snyder. I lost contact with Bob, but he's the one who sort of led me there. And the reason for the quote at the end is because that's the way I feel to this day very strongly, that to trust in the Lord with all my heart and lean not on my own understanding, as you say, in all my ways, acknowledge him and he will direct my path, and I believe that.
When you wake up every morning, Cliff, and you go to bed, what do you say to God?
I say thank you. Thank you. Thank you for my family, for how things have worked out in my life. I don't necessarily the life part, I don't say every night, but my family part I say every night. Thank you for how I've been blessed in so many ways. I can't recall them all, but that's what I do because he has been gracious and I've received his unmerited favor in so many ways.
So many people admire you. Who do you most admire?
My mom, I admire her because she had to pretty much raise me on her own. She was so well respected by friends and family. She loved children, and she was like a just a drew people to her. She was very generous, smart, and she was certain to be one of my favorite people. Jackie Robinson, what he had to overcome to be who he is, who he turned out to be. Obviously, that was when Martin Luther King, need I say more why on him? Billy Graham, I was in Vietnam, and he came to Vietnam when in the middle of the war and spoke to the troops under very trying conditions, and I could see the effect he was having on the troops. My pastor at my church, who was both a pastor and a missionary for his whole family was missionary in Africa for a long period of time. He grew up in Africa. And there are many more, but these are some that come to mind immediately.
Colonel Clipworthy, you went to the military academy, West Point, from 49 to 53, whose motto was duty, honor, and country. And sir, you've lived that your whole life. Thanks for your service to the country. Keep up the great work.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.
Believe in yourself.